Professor Kellison, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being with you today.
You were asked to compile a list that's in no specific order of lesser-known women who meet the Treasury Department's requirements for being on the $10 bill. They've said the woman selected should be iconic and have made a significant contribution to or impact on protecting the freedom on which the country was founded. So with that in mind, who's made your list?
So number one, and these aren't in a particular order as far as my preference, number one is Jane Addams. Jane Addams was a social reformer. She co-founded the Hull House, which was a social settlement or a settlement house in Chicago. And this was the late 1800s, early 1900s, the progressive period. And this is when a time when the country was urbanizing very rapidly. And so the idea was to create homes in urban areas where middle-class reformers would live, would share skills, would share education with immigrants, people from the working class, sort of for mutually beneficial, kind of trying to foster mutually beneficial relationships. Jane Addams was also very active in the pacifist movement. She established the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1931.
Now, number two and three on your list are related. Can you tell me a little bit more about them and their contributions to the growth of democracy?
Two and three are sisters, Angelina and Sarah Grimke. They were born into a slaveholding family in Charleston, South Carolina. Both of them moved north. Sarah was the eldest, and Angelina was the youngest, actually, of 14 children, and so there's a big age barrier between the two. They moved to Philadelphia, converted to Quakerism, and became abolitionists. And they also became champions of the women's rights movement, which was sort of in its bud, or the beginning phase as far as its organizational phase. They are really unique in the sense that they came from a slaveholding family in South Carolina. So a number of people in the abolitionist movement hadn't seen slavery firsthand as far as being born into a family where slavery was practiced. So they brought that particular kind of focus into that light. Fannie Lou Hamer is number four. She was a civil rights leader born into a sharecropping family in Mississippi, the youngest of 20 children. She helped organize voter registration drives in Mississippi and Delta, Mississippi, where there was just entrenched opposition to the right of African Americans to vote or be treated equally as citizens. She organized the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in support of African American voting rights, again, to draw attention to this really unapologetic nature of Southern segregation.
And number five on your list
is Harriet Jacobs, who was an ex-slave. Or she was born a slave, but then escaped to freedom, became an abolitionist. She wrote Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, basically to publicize her. She didn't publicize the escape to freedom per se because that was part of the Underground Railroad. She wanted to protect those people that helped her find her freedom or helped her to freedom. But she wrote about what it was like to be a slave. She was in a town called Edenton, which was in sort of coastal North Carolina. She lived 7 years in a small attic crawl space in Edenton before escaping to the north. And she stayed there because she was worried about her children who were still enslaved. And then she escaped to the north and her children subsequently also received their freedom.
And then six on the list is?
Is Mary Harris, Mother Jones, who sort of nicknamed herself Mother Jones, and that really stuck. She was a labor organizer and co-founder of the Industrial Workers of the World, which was a labor union in the early 20th century. But she was also very involved in organizing for the Knights of Labor and working particularly to advocate for child labor reforms. Just a really interesting speaker, very colorful. So really pushed for stricter child labor laws in particular. Jeanette Rankin is number seven. Jeanette Rankin was the first woman elected to the House of Representatives. She was from Montana. She was elected first in the 19-teens and then would serve again in the 1940s. She was a pacifist. She voted against American involvement in both World War I and World War II. She has a great quotation, which is, "I may be the first woman member of Congress, but I won't be the last." Ida B. Wells Barnett is the last person, again, not by kind of a hierarchical order, but right, simply by the name. She was born a slave in 1862. That's the middle of the Civil War, so she soon became free, as did all slaves. She lived in Memphis, Tennessee. Initially, she was a teacher, but then she got involved in writing for a newspaper. She was actually partner in a newspaper called the Free Speech and Headlight in Memphis, Tennessee. She challenged the very dominant culture of lynching as it became really embedded in the 1880s and especially 1890s and onward into the early 20th century. She had three friends in Memphis who were lynched, and she wrote about that pretty forcefully, so much so that she left Memphis. Her newspaper office was destroyed, moved to Chicago, but continued to write about and try to draw attention to the atrocities of lynching in the South. And one other thing about Wells Barnett, she challenged the Jim Crow system that was coming into place in the 1880s. She was on a first-class car in Tennessee. It was the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad. And she was ordered to leave that car and go to another car that had African Americans in it, and she refused to. And the conductor tried to remove her, and she bit him. And then two other men helped the conductor, the men working for the railroad company, helped the conductor forcibly remove her. She sued the railroad company, and initially won, but then that was reversed in a higher court.
And there's one more woman on your list, but you said she's more of a symbolic figure. Can you tell me more about her and just exactly what she embodies?
Right. She wasn't a real person that we know of, although her representation was based upon a model. This is Rosie the Riveter, who was sort of this, has become really an icon of women during World War II. She was, her portrait's made famous particularly by Norman Rockwell, who painted an image of a woman taking a lunch break, and she had a rivet gun in her lap. Her lunchbox said Rosie on it. There had been a song a year before that in 1942 that included the name Rosie, and Rosie was a riveter. Anyhow, this became very, very iconic. Again, even during World War II, it was distributed on this in the Saturday Evening Post, for which Norman Rockwell put a lot of pictures in. The magazine was loaned to the U.S. Treasury Department for the remainder of the war. It was used for the war bond drives. So it became, I think, circulated well in the 1940s, sort of rediscovered in the 1980s and onward, and again, a symbol of women during World War II. In an inclusive way, and then also an exclusive way as far as post-World War II, because the idea was women's patriotism, women should take their patriotism and move into male-dominated industrial positions because those men were fighting the war. So this is how they were helping the war effort. After World War II ended, women were supposed to move back into more traditional domestic roles.
Out of all the candidates you've listed, is there one that pops out to you as a potential front runner for the $10 bill?
Well, honestly, of the list that I was asked to make, which was an additional list to the list that the Women on 20s organizers put out on the internet. So these are also important women just to the cause of democracy. So on that list, I think it's still really up for debate. I think there's some that, again, I just kind of, maybe their personalities pull me to them. I think the Grimke sisters are very interesting because there were a lot of women in the South, the slaveholding South, who were born into slaveholding families. They're still the minority. Most people in the South were not in slaveholding families. But those in the elite, we have diaries of those women who might question a little bit about slavery, but who don't move into any type of anti-slavery kind of focus. The Grimke sisters did. You know, they left the South because of the harsh realities of slavery and because they disagreed with that. And so I think they're really unique in that sense.
Professor Kellison, thank you for talking with us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being with you today.
Kimberly Kellison is an associate professor and chair of the History Department in Baylor's College of Arts and Sciences.